My life. My life.
My life.
Amazing.
My life.
My life.
With
amazing.
My life.
Amazing strangers.
Hello to you, wherever you are in the world today, and welcome to My Life with Amazing Strangers. As the title suggests, I meet with people from all walks of life. We may have only met once or twice, perhaps never at all. Sometimes we've been introduced by people we know. Sometimes we've met on social media. However, we do have two things in common, and that's the care and the welfare of human beings. My name is Gary Robinson, once a full-time broadcaster for a living, now in my mid-50s, I'm exceptionally proud to be an outreach carer. So connection, compassion and care are high on my list of daily priorities. However, it's impossible to shelve the broadcaster in me, hence these broadcasts, podcasts, these audio actualities, if you like, where people tell me and you their unique and very special stories. So this is episode 2. My guest, my amazing stranger, is Chris Carse-Wilson, who's enjoying success with his debut novel. It's called Frey, set in the Scottish Highlands. A book with distinct elements of folk horror, says the bookseller Waterstones. Beautiful, amazing, completely mesmerising from the actor Alan Cumming. Weird and wild, says the Herald in Scotland. And recently, the Financial Times, the FT, reviewed Frey in Best New Debut Fiction. Chris recently described himself as thrilled and overwhelmed with all this. In this edition, together we'll find out more about Chris, who'll share his story of living with mental health and how creativity, exercise and the great outdoors helps him and will hopefully help you and people around you too. But just going back to those two adjectives of thrilled and overwhelmed, I started our chat by asking Chris how those two words have affected his life since the launch of his book in May 2023. My life with amazing stranger Chris Carse-Wilson.
I think that's very fair. I think that probably describes what the last couple of months have felt like, really. It's been interesting, you know, going from a position of being somebody who's always written, somebody who's always created things, but done so in secret. And, you know, it's only been the last couple of years that I really pursued the opportunity to try and to share my writing and then to get it published. So to go from that totally hidden world to have these reactions from, as you say, these incredible titles, but also particularly it's the other creative people who, you know, I've admired for years or decades even, and to have them see something in your work and to have them connect to it and you know, be emotionally moved by it, that's amazing.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because, you know, you're a man in terms of your professional background who's been used to putting other people in the spotlight in your career, and now you've found yourself in the spotlight. How have you found that transition?
It's been really interesting. So, you know, I've always worked professionally, as you say, in journalism initially, and then in communications afterwards. And I've done higher education work. I work now at V&A Dundee, the Design Museum, and I've always been telling the story for somebody else. You know, it's been putting an academic on the TV, or, you know, launching a museum or opening an exhibition. And that's, you know, that's interesting, that challenge. But then to apply it to you, where you're putting yourself forward, it's been exciting in a way, but it's been hard too, because part of the reason I wrote Frey, I felt I had to write it. And almost, to be honest, the entire reason why I decided to actually try and publish it rather than it just sort of living on my computer and in secret forever is because I wanted to talk about mental health, and I wanted to talk about my own challenges and, you know, how that might connect to other people. So there's this sort of twin side of putting yourself forward is slightly uncomfortable, but putting yourself forward in a way that actually, you know, you need to be really honest and has felt at times very vulnerable, quite challenging in itself. That's been tough at times, but it's important, and it's felt like something I really had to do. We said at the top of the interview that the book is set in the Scottish Highlands. And of course, without giving too much away, Chris, can you just give us a little bit more of the synopsis just to wet the whistle of listeners
Sure.
who may be thinking about purchasing this wonderful book of yours?
Sure, of course. So the book opens with a narrator whose father has fled to the Highlands of Scotland just after the death of his wife. And the narrator, who the book's mostly told through the voice of, chases afterwards, desperately trying to find the father. All they come across, though, is an abandoned cottage filled with thousands of paper notes in which the father's describing his attempts to, as he sees it, to actually find and rescue his dead wife. And the book has that tension about whether the father will be found, but is also looking really closely at, you know, what it means to have a mental health challenge, what grief means, what loss means, and how in those moments that, you know, are relevant to all of us, actually your sense of reality, your sense of what's going on in the world can be really distorted and really damaged. So it's the book in moments, it's up to the reader what is happening. You know, it twists and it turns and it'll take people into sort of some quite dark and quite exciting situations.
It's set in a part of the country which you absolutely love for various reasons, up in the north of Scotland, right up in the north. Was the book semi autobiographical in a way?
Yeah, I mean that's a really interesting question. I think the location is, in much the same way that the characters aren't named, and you know you have no sense of the age or the gender or the background to the narrator, which for me was always a really important thing, that you know I want readers to be able to put themselves in that situation or sort of connect to it. And it's been fascinating because people tell you that you know the character's definitely this or definitely that, and that's great that people come to it with their interpretation. But similarly with the landscape and the setting, it's just given us the Highlands. For me, it's kind of a composite of bits of Glencoe, where I had the inspiration for the book, and other bits of Scotland that I've been around and, as you say, really love. I think what's been the challenge and the interesting bit of writing it is I'm trying to use fiction, you know, very fictional situation, to speak honestly about my own experience and you know, and in turn then that of others. But it's the challenges that they're going through, and the setting is entirely of itself. You know, in the way that a landscape is made of bits and pieces that I've picked up over the years, I think the starting point for the characters is probably the same. It's fragments that have been brought together, but then have developed into something new.
Was it a cathartic experience writing the book?
Yeah, I think so. Definitely in moments, and I said earlier that, you know, I felt it was a book that I needed to write. You know, it wasn't something, you know, it wasn't sort of calmly and coolly sitting down and saying, okay, I fancy writing a book. This will be a nice experience. This is a nice challenge. I think for me, writing, which is partly why I've really done it in secret and generally really not told anybody about it, but writing has always been a way of dealing with my own challenges that I've had with anxiety and depression at times, and similarly running, which is another big part of my life. You know, that's something, you know, I need to write, it makes me feel better. I need to run, it makes me feel better. You know, I enjoy both these things very much, and they are, you know, integral parts of how I find some balance, you know, how I look after myself. To the point where if I stop running or stop writing, you know, you feel a difference pretty quickly, actually. So, you know, catharsis is a good way of putting it. And I think for me, a lot of it's about balance. You know, it's about finding the best way that I can to cope, to manage.
there's so many questions that I want to ask, and there's so many questions that you're answering for me with these wonderful answers. Because you've been so open about mental health, and it's good to be there, and it starts conversations. Were there some people who were taken by surprise at your honesty, at the fact that you've lived with mental health issues? Did it come as a surprise to some people? Did some people go, well, I know Chris well and I know what he's like? How did people react to that message very publicly that you've lived with mental health problems, issues?
It's a really good question. I think, the overwhelming reaction has been, I think, as you're saying at the start, there has been actually by me talking about my own situation, generally people have come to me and talked about theirs. And I find that really interesting. So there's a mix, there's a mix of people, entirely kind and compassionate responses. But generally with an aspect of people share something back. And I think that's the, that's, as I said earlier, that's a big part of the motivation, or possibly the entire motivation, frankly, for doing this, is trying to create something that, it's not about being a platform for me to have the conversation, but it's about using, a book, a piece of fiction, to talk about something that's entirely common to all of us. We all have mental health. It might be, I can't imagine what this might feel like, but it might be somebody might have good mental health in their entirety of their life, but they still have it, and it's still there, and it's still present every single day. I think when I started writing the book, why grief was such an important factor to begin the story with is, very sadly, that is an experience that we will all go through at some point. But then it becomes a common denominator. It's almost, I feel, at least for me, it's almost a sort of a socially acceptable form of a mental health challenge to talk about. So, we all have a language to talk about grief in some way, but we possibly don't in the same way about anxiety problems or about depression or about whatever other challenges people might face. So I think the book, writing the book, hopefully, it helped me. It's helped others that I've had conversations with, who, as you say, have kind of reacted back to me. But hopefully it's also a useful thing for some readers to, in a gentle way, maybe look at themselves a little more closely, maybe feel empowered that they're not alone in the challenges and the struggles that they face. I think back to being, very much younger, so I'm just sort of in my early 40s now, so born in the beginning of the 80s. And certainly, growing up when I did, the number of people in the public eye who spoke about mental health at all was vanishingly small. It was a very lonely time to feel that way. And what's difficult about that, if we don't talk about these things, is, you feel exceptional, you feel different, you might feel broken and beyond saving as a result of it, when actually what we should all be understanding is that these feelings are, to a varying degree, are common to all of us, or could be given a particular situation. So I think, it's been really heartening that people have felt that because I've talked, that they can talk too.
When you were going through the creative process of writing the book, which I do note that a lot of my colleagues in the media love the fact that you wrote it on a bus, some of it, but we won't go into that too much. We won't play on that too much, but I think it's a fascinating thing that the media have picked up on. But did you, in terms of your thought process and your moods and your mental health, whether it be you know, light mental health or darker moments. Did that help you in the creative process of putting the book together? Because, you know, as I said, you know, one of the quotes from Waterstones was a book with distinct elements of folk horror. So did sometimes some of the darker moments, did that help with the writing, with the creative process?
Yeah, it's an interesting thought. I think, you know, at a very basic level, if I'd not had the experiences that I've had for, you know, on and off, not all the time, but for a long period of my life, I wouldn't have been able to write the book. And I think it's, you know, so there's a couple of things wrapped up in there. You know, part of it is what I said earlier about feeling the need to write it. So that's partly about, well, at that point, because I was, when I first started writing, as you say, mostly the first version, Tile on the Bus, which a few of your media friends have certainly picked up on. When I started writing, I had no intention of ever showing it to anyone. So at that point, it was just for me. It only the thought that it could become a book and could become a sort of positive and a useful thing only really came later. But I think one of the things that I'm aware of, proud of probably, is the, without giving anything away, the book has a sort of a tense climax moment towards the end. There's a combination of lots of different things that all come together in a sort of challenging, extended chapter. And I wrote that bit while, to be honest, I was really quite unwell. So I was signed off from work. I was really, what I discovered later, after receiving a very late diagnosis as being autistic, later discovered was, you know, sort of an autism-related burnout. But really, really unpleasant time period, I was still, you know, I was able to put some of that pain and some of that difficulty down on the page and into this. And I think that, you know, being able to, I think, I don't know, it's, it helped me probably process some of those challenges. And I think also, for me, it's probably always been a way of grounding myself when things have felt really difficult. It's, you know, the writing is a thing to keep coming back to. It's a routine, it's a method, and it's something that, you know, generally I will feel better for doing afterwards.
That diagnosis, the late diagnosis of autism, did that come as a surprise? And if it did it then become a wee bit of a relief? Did things start to make sense about how you'd been feeling in the past?
I mean, definitely makes sense, but over quite a long period. So, I mean, I've had my diagnosis now for about a year or two. So, you know, I've lived pretty much 40 years of my life not knowing, whilst having all of the associated challenges of my particular sort of profile as an autistic person. And then I've had a year or two of starting to understand it and to look at how I react to the world and see why I might flourish in some particular situations and might massively struggle in others, when I can never understand why what seemed like everybody else was completely fine or was doing okay. The process itself, though, took a very long time, as is the case for lots of people. You know, I'm fortunate that I was able to get an NHS diagnosis at all. You know, I know that's not something to be taken for granted. But it still took 2 years or more for the referral to go through, and then process of the actual sort of assessment was done in stages of as Zoom calls, because it was COVID times, over a couple of months. But I think there what I come back to, and I suppose what I take, something that I really admire, is what the only thing, genuinely, the only thing that started my journey to a diagnosis was seeing Chris Packham do a previous documentary, not the most recent ones, but a previous documentary in which he talked, I think, for the first time in detail about his own diagnosis and about how he, you know, the situations in which he functions and thrives and the others in which he doesn't. And that was a real, it sounds slightly cliche, but that was a real light bulb moment of, oh my goodness, this is how I feel. And until watching that program, I really had no idea at all that, you know, the sensory challenges that I might face and sort of the resultant anxiety, you know, reliance on routine and being absolutely destroyed by disruption to it and lots and lots of other things, that this was the root cause of it. So, you know, it's been interesting that the diagnosis came actually just after, the book was almost finished. So Frey was almost done at the point at which I got that. There are bits in it that I can see now I'm drawing on that experience without having the words to put to it, without knowing what it is. But it's certainly something now that, you know, for my next book, which I'm writing at the minute, autism is certainly something I'm going to look at much more closely, because it's obviously still very much misunderstood. And, you know, I personally feel I have a lot to learn about the huge range of autistic people and autistic experiences, and in turn, to learn about myself.
Education plays a really important part in this process, I'm sure. I've done an interview recently with a father of an autistic young man, actually. The young man, he's 26. And they, both of them together, have a Twitter feed, and it's called, whether the interview's gone out before or after, but people will be able to see it anyway. But it's called Autism Care and Share, is the Twitter page, and it's brilliant. And I was asking Dad about education and saying, you know, do people get it? Because he was saying that, you know, his son Ryan, you know, people would be unkind, or they're not understanding, or they'd say, control your child, or why is he making that noise, or shut him up, or and come away with all sorts of things that actually I couldn't fathom. It's just not within my DNA to do that. And it still seems, and he said, I used to get really angry by that, but he said, I've chilled out an awful lot more because it's about a lack of education. So he was he wasn't blasé about it at all, but he suddenly started taking the anger and the sting out of the stigma, and going, well, actually, we mustn't blame people for being uneducated. He didn't use the word ignorant, but I'm using that now. So he really turned it around. So education, from what I can fathom out from these interviews, plays a very, very important part in understanding all sorts of mental health issues, ADHD, autism, and so on. Is your two questions really? Is your book doing that, do you think, in a way? Is it highlighting mental health, although maybe not overtly? And do you think the education, really, in terms of for understanding, for the public to understand, is absolutely the way to go, hence your second book? Yeah, gosh, that was a long question, wasn't it?
It's all right. Well, you might need to ask the second part again, but let me go on the first part to start with. I think it's really interesting, and it's good to hear what he's saying. I mean, I think there's obviously a caveat to that, that, you know, bullying or bad or abusive behavior is wrong, full stop, whether someone's uneducated or not uneducated. But I think if we take Frey and think about mental health, part of the reason why it's all presented in the first person, so it's the narrator's diary as they're trying to find their father. That's intercut with these notes that the father's left, just detailing his his attempts to try and find his dead wife, who he's convinced isn't dead. By putting everything into the first person, I wanted to get as I wanted to bring readers as close as possible to the experiences that each of the characters are having. So one of them is, it understands what's going on and, you know, is lucid and is explaining it. The other one, you know, a reader might think that the father is hallucinating. They might think that he's having other challenges. You know, some people, it's been really interesting. Some people read the book and thought, you know, everything in it is completely real. And some people thought everything in it's completely imagined by one or both of the characters. I'm happy to take either interpretation of it. But I want it to be getting into people's heads. That was really the point, the whole point of the book. So that then, whether you've had those experiences or not, you're being brought up close to them and you can see what it feels like. I think to the second point about increasing education, I mean, I think for me, one of the things I find really fascinating is being newly diagnosed, the information that I received after the diagnosis was, you know, minimal, was bordering on non-existent. You know, it's very much the capacity within the NHS was to diagnose, and then it was, you know, congratulations, you're diagnosed, goodbye. I was very fortunate. I was able to get, I was connected with a service in Edinburgh called Number Six, and they had a small funding pot for late diagnosed adults to run a sort of, you know, an education program, I guess it was, you know, sort of 8 weeks of a couple of hours on an evening each week. And that was great. The other thing that's been great is just the, you know, it's a positive side of social media. And you know, there's a lot of challenges, a lot of negatives about social media and the way things can be online. But actually, as a space for people to talk, to show themselves, to talk about their experiences, to share that, to put videos up, you know, not that long ago, that simply didn't exist. So I think the education matters, community really matters, you know, people feeling safe and empowered to speak up. And again, that just comes back to that kind of the principle that said earlier is really behind Frey, is that, you know, the more we feel, we all feel empowered to talk about our you know, our own situations, our own challenges, the more we're going to help other people. And I think that's really, really crucial.
Another momentous day for you today, Runner's World, a magazine you've read for 30 years, published a double page spread. Well, you've been in it previous, I understand, but there was something very special in there. Was that very recently? Was that today? Did that
come out? Yeah, no, today. So it's in newsagents everywhere today, which is truly a baffling feeling. You know, as you say, somebody who's run for 30 years, you know, sometimes done bits of races and things, but always had that sense that running was a really, you know, before I even had the words to describe why I needed it, I knew I needed it. I knew that I always felt better after a run. So yeah, Runner's World, quite remarkably, so took used a photo of me from up in Glencoe, again, where the inspiration for the book really struck, showing me running through that landscape. But importantly, you know, they ran some, a few words along the side, talking about mental health, talking about anxiety, talking about autism. So, you know, I think that's something that it's been really consistent through all of the media attention, is using that to keep talking about it. You know, it's great to talk about the book, and obviously people have really loved the book, and I'd be delighted that the more people pick it up and read it. But that's much less important than actually talking about mental health and talking about that other side of things.
Yeah, radio is a national radio station. You and I are both based in Scotland, lucky enough to be in Scotland. And when I say lucky, I'm talking about, well, there's a lot of things that we love about Scotland, of course, certainly a lot of things that I love about Scotland. But in terms of its geographical splendour, like Glencoe, for instance, is, I mean, we're spoiled, and sometimes we don't realize how spoiled we are. I mean, one of the things where I get my head together is I go, and you'll know this, Chris, you'll know the place, but many people won't, but I go and sit on the seafront in a little seaside town called Carnoustie, and I've got my favorite bench, and I look out to sea, and when it's still, it's just like a mirror. I mean, it's absolutely wonderful. And I, you know, it takes me 10 minutes to get my head together, and then I'm happy again. So we're in a wonderful place. Not everybody's lucky enough to have the great outdoors that we have for exercise, for ecotherapy, if you like. So what would your advice be to somebody who's city centre somewhere in this great country of ours? How would you encourage them, or what advice could you give them, Chris, to do what I do, but in the environmental setting in which they find themselves in?
Yeah, no, it's really interesting, and it's interesting that where you're talking about, where you go to get yourself together and to feel better, is for listeners who are sort of aware of the areas, almost exactly over the water from where I go in Tensmere Forest, to take a run. So we're probably looking over the water at each other while we're out there.
Give you a wave next
time. Exactly. So, I mean, I think for me, though, there are huge, huge benefits to being out in nature, and I absolutely love it. But it's the exercises for personally, is really essential. So, you know, if I was, the only way of getting my running was on a treadmill in a gym, I would still do it, you know, and certainly other places I've lived, I might have done most of my running around city streets or in an entirely different environment. I think, you know, I know quite a lot of people who, they might live city centre and they might benefit from, you know, if they're lucky enough to have parks or little pockets of green land where they are, or even they might just get one run a week that's on the weekend, and they jump on a train or a bus or take the car out of the city, and that's their little escape, that's their moment of getting away into nature. But I think the thing I've learned over the years is what's mattered most for me is routine. So it's about consistency. So ideally, every day, every other day, getting a run, getting a bit of writing, that will help me, you know, no matter where I am, no matter how good things might be or bad things might be, I will feel a little bit better for doing it, but also for knowing that in another day or another 2 days, I'm going to be doing the same again. So I wouldn't want anyone to ever feel that, you know, that if they don't have nature on the doorstep, that they can't be proactively looking after themselves and they can't be helping them, you know, their mental health. I think one of the things as well on that is, you know, come back to the idea of community. So I've taken a lot from other people who on social media have been generous enough to and brave enough to talk about their own experiences of being autistic and particularly being diagnosed later in life. But if people are looking to, you know, if people want to explore exercise and might be, think that could help them or feel that maybe feel a bit nervous about doing it, you know, there are so many running clubs, running groups that, you know, range from everything from ultra competitive through to totally relaxed and just friendly. And then there's the huge, like, you know, global network of park run activities, you know, on a Saturday morning, that's all over the world, you know, these wonderful volunteer-led free 5K runs, and people of all ages, all abilities, all levels of fitness and whatever will turn up, and they might run, they might race, they might walk the whole thing. But that, again, that sense of community belonging and lack of judgment, but also for me, routine, you know, that's to know you can go anywhere and there's a park run on a Saturday morning within pretty easy reach, whether you're in the center of a city or way out in the wilderness somewhere, is a remarkable thing. It's wonderful.
I love the quote that you gave the Herald up here in Scotland when they asked you five words to describe Glencoe, and they were all it was just so wonderfully it was contradiction. I love it. So I've got them here: beautiful, brutal, calming, stirring, threatening. And I read those five words, and you know, because I've never been to Glencoe, I've seen pictures, and there's other parts of Scotland and other parts of the UK which are equally as beautiful, so I've got to be very careful in the interest of balance here. But I thought those five words just summed it up absolutely perfectly. And if there was ever a reason to go to that part of the world, those five words for me absolutely did it. So I thought that was really powerful, Chris.
No, that's very kind. Thank you. I think it's interesting you picked up on that. I think there's certainly something in the book as well of looking at those natural environments that, you know, look stunning. And, you know, we all see these things online, on Instagram or wherever, and look really great, but actually can be genuinely beyond terrifying and dangerous, you know, in that up in Glencoe and any mountainous area, you know, people, very sadly, people will die every year, or people will have serious injuries and need mountain rescue, need helicopters, need whatever it may be. And I think for me, for putting a book together that is dealing with the, you know, the full range of what a mental health experience might be and the challenges that somebody might go through, to that landscape is just, it's a gift to use. And to be honest, until I'd gone there, and this was back sort of 7 years ago that I started writing the book, I knew I wanted to write something in this area. I knew I wanted to do something about mental health. I didn't have a story. I didn't have a clear idea of what that might be. And the thing that unlocked it was it wasn't the middle of the winter. We were up there in October, and I went out and run, and it was, you know, it's kind of a gray day. It wasn't terrible. The weather wasn't predicted to be bad. I wouldn't have gone out if it was, because that's not an environment I'm routinely in. I'm not, you know, a mountaineer or anything like that. But I was going up the side of this mountain, got about 500 meters up, and the weather just changed instantly, and all the visibility went, and the wind was, you know, storm strength, the rain absolutely horizontal, lashing into you, and it was so frightening. And just, you know, that moment, you know, I turned around instantly, kind of came back down the mountain, obviously wasn't going to keep going up, but that feeling of being so small and so helpless against the landscape, that was what kind of unlocked it. It's like, okay, here is a physical setting that looks great much of the time, but actually my how safe I am, I may or may not be totally in control of. And that felt like, you know, I've said this a few places, but it did genuinely feel like seeing in the world what a mental health challenge can feel like internally. And that storm felt like, okay, this is like bringing it out and making, you know, describing it in clouds and in rain and in wind. And really that was, you know, that was the moment of like, okay, I want to put this feeling down onto a page. This is the way I can begin to tell a story.
There's a second book, and I won't press you too much on that, Chris, because I know you were very or you had certain parameters when you were writing the first book, if you like, you weren't going to tell anybody, and then you did, and so on. So you may be going through that process again. Obviously, the creative process takes as long as it takes, but is there anything you can leave us with that gives us a little taste of what your reader can expect next from you?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think part of the game of having a book out and you know, having wonderful conversations like this is I do feel more comfortable talking about other things that I'm writing. And you know, I suppose partly it's that I now have a reason to, like, oh, sorry, I understand the benefit of it. And that's not to, you know, that's not, God, it's definitely not self-promotion or anything like that. It's about just talking about things I'm passionate about and things that really mean something to me and hopefully connect and mean something to other people. So, you know, as we've discussed, Frey is looking at mental health and grief up in the Highlands of Scotland. The second book, which is still, you know, mid-writing, you know, might not be out for another couple of years because these things do really take a long time. But that's going to be looking much more closely at autism. So having had my diagnosis in my early 40s, I'm really interested in everything I didn't know, frankly, and taking that as a starting point. But also looking back at the history of, you know, this whole spectrum of conditions that really in the very first scientific literature on it is only in the 1940s, which, you know, really isn't actually that long ago. And the entire field of scientific research into it has been so just overrun with error and prejudice and just horrible, horrible assumptions that have, you know, really made life horrendous for many autistic people over the decades. I think there's something really interesting there, and it comes back to what you were saying before about education and understanding. You know, I'm looking at how I can use fiction and to tell a story over different time periods, so pretty much spanning the period from when the first scientific research came out through to now, but looking at what the experiences of different people at different times may have been. So actually, how were they misunderstood? How were they treated? So that's the starting point, and it's still very, very early. But that's the new sort of set of challenges that I want to try and tackle through a piece of fiction.
My life, amazing. My life,
my life,
amazing. My life.
That was My Life with Amazing Stranger Chris Cass-Wilson.
Amazing Strangers.
In the next episode, I'll be joined by not one, not two, but three amazing strangers representing the organisation Changing Faces, supporting people with a visible difference. Isabella, John and Naomi will share their stories of living everyday life with a visible difference, how language and education plays a massive, massive part in changing hearts and minds, and ultimately we'll be asking the question, as a society, are we getting better at understanding visible differences? So until next time, please feel free once again to liberally share what you've heard and hopefully learned today. I'm so grateful for your company as always, and thank you for listening.